Get ready, golf lovers. The boys are teed up and ready to go. Backspin, thanks to Inside Golf.
Hello, friends. Welcome to this tradition unlike any other.
And hello, friends. Hello, friends. Hello, friends.
Hello, friends. How do I sound, guys?
Like, not like Jim Nance.
Don't I?
No.
I want to be Jim Nance just for this week.
No.
I want to be Jim Nance just for the rest of my life. Welcome to Backspin, brought to you by Inside Golf Magazine and BMW Australia. Gary Barter, you're there. Larry Canning, I'm here. It is Masters Week, guys. I'm very excited. I love watching the first major of the year. It's a funny one, the Masters, because there's only 90-odd players in it. We often don't see someone we haven't heard of win the Masters. It's usually someone who has some experience playing the golf course. Your thoughts on Augusta, the Masters, where does it fit in your four majors? What number would you put it?
Interesting. It was always the one that had the most presence. It seemed to be the one that had the most fanfare. The British Open traditionally is the big grand event.
Mm.
It's the one
156 starters, guys.
But the Masters was something that we all looked forward to. I still look forward to it. It's got...
How many you reckon you've watched?
I know I've watched everyone from 1960.
You couldn't have. You weren't born in 1960.
But I watched...
Oh, you've watched them in...
Yeah, when I... I worked at the New South Wales Golf Association when I was younger, and they had all the official films from 1960 to 1980.
Right. So you've watched them. Okay.
I think being the same course every year,
tradition
of the Masters.
It's definitely special. Now, we haven't played the Masters, obviously, but we do have a couple of guests that have played, a couple of mates, Craig Parry and Peter Lonard, both Masters competitors. Craig nearly won it. In fact, had a three-shot lead going into about the third or fourth hole on Sunday. It was eventually overtaken by Fred Couples. So we're going to be talking to those two guys about Augusta, and I'm looking forward to that. How they played it, their experience. I always begin the question when I talk to someone who's played it, what's it like getting in there, driving in to Augusta National?
Magnolia Lane.
Mm. Yeah, what's that experience like? So I'll be interested to hear that. So we'll be hearing from both the two boys in our show. You and I are going to have a crack at who's going to win the Masters, and I think we need to involve a little wager. And we do not endorse betting, but just between us, I think if I was to pick a winner, what would you do for me? Because I think I'm going to pick the winner.
I'll give you a chipping lesson.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll shout you a chipping lesson.
So if you win, what will I do for you?
Don't take the chipping lesson. That's a win for me.
I was going to say, I'll wash your beautiful car. In fact, I'll wash Nicole's BMW. That's what I'll do.
Okay. All right.
Gaz, we've been looking at players leading up to the Masters, as we always do. We're looking at form. But Augusta presents a little more than just form, doesn't it? It presents a golf course that few people really know well, and the ones that do have a huge advantage. So, given that, who do you see is going to be holding the green – well, not holding the green jacket, wearing the green jacket?
Yeah, nothing's easy, but it'd be one of the easy ones to pick. You can single it. A, you've got to be – you've got to have the game.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see form around there. You've got to be able to get on that 16th tee and 17th tee, 18th tee and actually get it in the clubhouse. Like to actually have the intestinal fortitude to win that great championship with just how loud that place is and just the arousal level of that place. And to win the green jacket, you saw what it meant to Rory last year and how many tries he's had. So you're definitely looking at someone coming into the event in form, someone who can actually win the championship, someone that's got the game around there. I looked at it last night and I thought to myself, is it Fleetwood's time? I like DeChambeau. He's been playing well. He knows the golf course. He's got a tremendous record around there. Rory is clearly the best player. Scheffler's coming in not in great form, but the course just suits him. Like down to the ground. Then I thought, there's a real roughie. I thought Michael Kim, he was 501 to win, $67, I think, on the betting last night to finish in the top five. Not to win the tournament, but I thought as a roughie, top five. But then he finished the second today in San Antonio, so his odds have halved. So that was going to be a bit of mail, but it's not that great now. But if I'm going to have to pick one, I'm going to go Bryson.
I'll give you a roughie, a winner and a roughie. So
okay.
Take your roughie. Yep. Your roughie is?
I'll go Patrick Reed.
Okay. No, you can have him. You can have Patrick Reed because I'm not really a fan of Patrick. I am a massive fan of Adam Scott. He's my roughie.
Oh, wouldn't that be amazing?
Wouldn't it?
That'd
yeah,
be so
no cool. one knows that place better. No one knows more about that golf course in that field, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, and he's playing well.
Maybe Rory, but no, Adam Scott. Yeah, and he's playing well, and he's on a trend. He's on a really gentle upward trend, heading towards something large, and I believe he's going to be in the mix. I think John Rahm's going to win. Your thoughts on that?
He's playing amazing. He's playing incredible. Like, so he plays well around Augusta. He ticks every box. So,
and he's got a point to prove. He feels like he hasn't won a major for too long. He feels like, this is my opinion, which is usually right, Gaz, as you know, that John Rahm has a chip on his shoulder and he wants to prove to the world
he's angry all the time,
whatever
John.
Europe aren't giving him to change their mind and give him some kind of exemption back onto that tour.
Yeah, is he going to feel comfortable straight back in that environment again? That's the question, isn't it? The LIV players coming back just in the locker room again, just the feel of... Yeah, playing a...
You're talking about just a regular event or the Masters?
Just the Masters and a major, just any event out of that comfort zone they've been in. So, but look, Rahm...
I think he likes not being in a comfort zone.
Yeah, he's always got that sort of angry chip.
It's a big chip.
Yeah.
It's a potato. It's like, it's the Robertson big potato on his shoulder.
Yeah, they were all world class. They're all got a chance, but I'll stick with DeChambeau.
What do you think Jim Nantz can come up with this week that he hasn't already said? He's got something up his sleeve, surely. No, he's using a lot of old material.
And we love it.
We do adore it.
Yeah, we love it.
He's got to come up with something new. And it'll be in the first intro. Won't be just the hello, friends. Welcome to a tradition unlike any other.
Well, there's no Tiger this year. There's no Phil this year.
Okay, so tradition's gone.
So it's starting to change a little bit, isn't it?
Mm.
It's starting to change. So, yeah, I'm sure they'll be missed, but the tournament will go on.
So, Gary, we'll be back chatting with Peter Lonard after this break.
I'm looking forward to that.
You're tuned to Backspin. 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 With Larry Canning and Gary Barter.
Welcome to Backspin, Peter. How are you, mate?
Oh, thanks. Great to be here, Larry.
Gary and I have been wondering. We just wonder, don't we, really, guys? But one of the things we wondered was what it's like the first time you drive down Magnolia Drive. Magnolia Lane, in fact. Pete, was it terrifying? Was it inspiring? Was it exciting? What was it?
Oh, well, it was obviously a dream come true getting that little invitation. And, it's funny, I had a very bad filing system then, and as I do now. And I'd just gotten my card over in America, and I've been playing quite consistently. So I actually had no ID or anything involved with the tournament. I played, they used to play in Atlanta the week before, and then we'd go from Atlanta to Augusta, just drive there. And anyway, so I thought, well, what do? I suppose I drove my truck up there. So I had the truck in Atlanta, and then I thought, well, I'll just drive to the course. So when we got to Augusta, I'm a bit nervous. Look, the whole town shuts down for this tournament. I've been watching on telly my whole life. I had my caddy with me, and I thought, well, how the hell do we get in? What do we do? So we found this little gate on the main drive. I thought, well, I'll just drive in, and he probably won't believe me, but we'll give it a go. So we rocked in this big black F-150, and he got to the front gate, and the guy said, can I help you? And I said, I've got no credentials or anything, but my name's Peter Lyon. I'm playing this week. I think he said something like, this is your first week at Augusta. I said, yeah, this is my first tournament. He said, okay. He said, well, you've got two options. Didn't really check anything. He just said, okay. And then he said, you can drive down Magnolia Lane, turn right around in front of the clubhouse and go back to the car park, or you can turn right here and not worry about Magnolia Lane and just go park in the players' parking. And I looked at him and I said, I think I might drive down Magnolia Lane if that's okay. And he said, sure, knock yourself out. Have a good day. And I was in. So, he was very trusting, I've got to say.
Do you reckon Gary and I could have a chance of getting in there then? Yeah.
You can have a go. It's seriously worth a go. All you've got to do is say no, isn't it?
Peter Lonard.
Yeah,
oh, geez, you've aged, mate. Show us your golf swing. That's not Peter Lonard. And then from there on, mate, the first experience, who'd you meet and was it, who was the chairman back then? Was it Horton? Hootie Johnson.
Hootie Johnson.
Did you meet Hootie?
No, I didn't really meet anybody. I just, went and parked my car. And it was one of the only times that I've been a little uncomfortable in the grounds of a golf course. I've got to say, trying not to do anything wrong and, where to go and what to do and all that sort of stuff. I had been there before. I went in 97 when Tiger won, just to watch. I'm not a good spectator, I've got to say, so it was far better being there as a player. And then that was it. It was, go register, get your badge, and, we've had a while to get ready for this. So I had a bunch of friends coming, and you know, I was really looking forward to having a good week, big week. And as it turned out, it rained and just poured down the whole week. So I think I got 9 holes on Monday, 9 holes on Wednesday, and that was about it.
Did you play with anyone that had experience? Did you seek someone out?
No, I just thought, well, you know, it'll be okay. It's no big deal. It's just another golf course, and I, you know, they'll just put me with a couple of normal guys, and I can just try and sneak around the first day or two and work out how to do it. And, you know, on the weekends, hopefully I'll be all right. And they snuck me around the back with Phil Mickelson and David Toms. So, of course, they're straight under the gauntlet. So, the first go was interesting. There was so much to learn and know about the course that I probably didn't know. Near the end, I sort of thought maybe I have an idea what's going on. But, it's a very tricky course.
Pete, everyone says it's a lot more undulating, like what you imagine on the TV.
One of the hilliest golf courses you would ever play. It was one of the few courses. Like, I was playing 35 tournaments a year, maybe even more, between Europe and America and Australia. And, you know, I don't know about exceptionally fit, but I was really fit as far as walking course. That was the one course at the end of the week you're actually exhausted just from walking up and down the hills and around and all that sort of stuff.
And what about the green complexes? They're just like...
Greens were a lot smaller than I expected. Like, on TV, they look quite large. The depth were quite narrow in most sections, so your depth perception had to be great. And even on the longer greens, you know, there were a lot of tiers. They were far more undulating greens I ever expected to see as well. So, you know, as far as the course was concerned, like, just the change in elevations was incredible. So, you know, you're hitting uphill, downhill. Your lies were always higher than your feet, lower than your feet. You never really had a flat lie unless you could hit it to the bottoms of the hills, which I probably wasn't long enough to do.
Is it true you need like a high ball flight around there? Like, is it?
Yeah, high draw. Everyone says like high draw.
Trevino never won the Masters, and he always said that he just couldn't really get to the. He said he couldn't drive it probably far enough. He said, I'd always get the top of the hills. I'd never get the runoff. And he said that, like, trajectory into the greens. And Trevino's regarded as probably the best ball striker outside Hogan of all time, like proximity to the hole. But he definitely, you know, I've watched a lot of Masters, and he didn't figure that much.
I found it difficult, I must admit. Like, I like trying to cut it a bit. Like, I probably wasn't quite long enough in those days. Like, when I started, my first one was 03, maybe 02, 03, I reckon. And they'd started extending the course at that stage. But it was amazing how cold it was.
Okay.
Cooler than I was expecting. And the damage it did to your ball flight, as far as length goes, I found really difficult to do.
Oh, really? It's interesting.
Yeah, so, once it warmed up in the afternoon, the course was great fun to play. But in the mornings, I found it pretty difficult when it was cool, cold. You know, you never had a flat ball lie. It was always uphill, downhill. And some of the corners in those greens were incredible to get to. And there was an art to getting to certain corners. It's an incredible place to play.
Speaking of cold, playing a practice round with Mickelson, was that a bit fresh? Was that a bit cool?
No, he was good.
Really?
I've heard a million stories. Not a million stories, but, you know, a lot of guys say that, you know, they aren't fans or anything. But, he was always very nice to me. I played with him at a few World Tour events, and he was always good to me. We did have a funny moment on the ninth. Okay, so there's a lot of local knowledge that goes in, and the ninth green has like three tiers going.
Yep.
It sort of sits a bit off-center to you at an angle, and the pin was in the back left corner. So anyways, I had about a 6-iron in. So I hit a 6-iron up to the right edge and in the middle tier, and so pretty much where you want to go unless you're going to have a go at the flag. But, you know, you can get into a lot of trouble doing that. So, I was happy to hit it there. Mickelson did he probably got 9-iron, I reckon. He hit so far that day, it was unbelievable. Our balls were right next to each other, and so we were sort of on the right fringe in the middle tier, and it was my putt first, so I walked up around the green, the edge of the green, and had a look from the other side, then I walked all the way back, and I've always paced my putts when I hit putts. So I walked down, I hit my putt up there, and it goes to probably 4 feet under the hole. Not a bad putt. Anyway, I see Mickelson line up, and I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, I've just walked on his line about 20 feet. Right? And I'm thinking, he can't be hitting it on that line, surely. Anyway, he hit it a line that just I didn't, could never sort of imagine. He hit it like probably 20 degrees, 30 degrees right of where I did mine, but exactly where I walked, trying not to walk on anybody's line. He just rolled it up my footprints, basically. You could see it, obviously.
You could see it bouncing.
Yeah, and then it sort of came back from the top edge and then rolled backwards down towards the altar, you know, an inch or two or something, and then he tapped it in. And when we finished, I said, oh, listen, I'm sorry, I can't. Basically got you on every step I took there. and he just laughed. He said, oh, don't. He said, listen, unless you played you 100 times, you would never even think of that. I was like, okay, well, that's all right. And then outside of that, he was great. He accepted that pretty well. Could have copped a bit of a spray in the old days, I'm sure we would have. I always found him pretty good. The thing with him was that when you played with him, he wanted you, or the way I felt was that he wanted you to play really well. He wanted you to shoot 65, but he was going to shoot 62.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting.
And he sort of tried it always felt like he was trying to get everybody to get going, even though he thought he was going to beat you. But all the good players thought, you know, Norman, they all spoke to you like, I'm going to get you.
Yeah. I'm getting off the track here. Sorry, mate. Is there someone that you didn't like playing with? Is there someone that, geez, I don't want it. Was a Faldo or someone like that? Or someone like Tiger because he was that good?
I actually liked playing with the really good players. It was good fun. There weren't any that I walked off going, I don't want to do that again. I just liked playing against them. It was good fun.
It was good
to see where your game stood and all that sort of stuff. But I did play. There was, I played with Tiger a fair few times. Like, not a lot, but probably 10 times, I suppose. I always remember I played with him at San Diego. He won the Buick. I was in the last group with him and Tom Lehman, and it was at 36 holes in the one day. And I always remember we hit off the tent. Anyway, he hits his driver, I hit my driver. We walk up. I'm looking for the ball. I can't see it. I can see his ball. I'm looking like 30 yards behind him for this ball. Anyway, all I can hear is these people going, further up, further up. And my ball was 30 yards past him.
Oh, nice.
So I don't know whether I bounced three sprinkler heads in a row or how I got there. But I always remember that. It was very funny. Even my caddy was laughing. He was going, how the ball get up here? I don't know.
So did Tiger talk to you at all during when you played with him? Was he a talker or he was just focused?
He wasn't a big talker, but I wasn't a talker. You basically just talked to your caddy and, you know, that was about it.
No good having you and Tiger around for a dinner party.
Oh, no, we'd go all right with
Lionel. Yeah, he's got some stories.
We could go all right. But he's in the office and, you know, certain players like Jackin and, you know, like Sabatini, he'd be yakking the whole way around, you know, call you over and, you know, have a look at this lie. And you go, well, what, do you want to drop or something? He goes, no, just have a look at it. You know? You have to walk 30 yards back to your ball and go, well, why did I do that? So everyone was a bit different. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's about of working out how you play best, I think.
So the six times you played there, did they keep evolving the golf course? Did they keep changing it? Would you go there and each year you'd see something a bit different, something lengthened or?
Yeah, they changed it every year, but the hard thing was actually picking what they changed. You know, I reckon over the years, the first hole they've moved the tee back a bit, but it still looks exactly the same, or they've moved the bunker a bit further past. They've lengthened carries, but it'd look exactly the same. You know, last year I just whacked it over the bunker on the right, and then all of a sudden that bunker's another 5 or 10 yards longer, but it looks exactly the same, unless you're looking at the ball. You're in for a bit of a shock. So the first year when I played Mickelson, he was smashing it. The drive was going so fast. He stood up on the 11th every day, and he whacked it down the right edge over the pines into the rough there, and there was no trees, and it rolled down the thing. He had like 9-iron wedge in every day. Anyway, the next year we came back, there was 100 fully grown pine trees littered down that where he hit it. It was incredible.
They plant a fully grown pine tree. Oh, gee. I was reading some weird Augusta facts, and the sand, it's not actual sand. It's actually granulated quartz.
Is that right?
A material so pure. It's $10,000 American per ton. I've got a couple of ton arriving tomorrow. Just like around the launch.
So what do you need a short game around that place? Would you say if you had to have something other than length?
If you don't have length, you've got to have the ability to hit it into certain positions, have it well mapped out. You got to have a wedge game. Like, I never did any good there. But I had my kryptonite, which was putting over tiers. The ones that I played on the Thursdays and Fridays, most of the pins were on the tops of the hill. You had these small landing zones to get it close to the end. And then if it didn't land in that spot, it would trickle down. You know, you'd have a 40-footer up over tiers. And the pace, your pace had to be perfect. And I was just never any good at it. I practiced and tried and never really worked out how to do it. But that's what I found the most difficult. Chipping was difficult because they actually mow the grass backwards in every direction. So you're always chipping into grain. It's always really tight. Chipping is incredibly difficult.
Mowing the grass backwards is another interesting fact too, Pete, you've touched on there, because I read that as well, that they mow so the grain's always against you, no matter where you are. That's an art in itself to be able to do that. I mean, you've got to have the mowers going all the same direction, don't you?
You notice a lot of the guys will chip in practice rounds, and then you watch them play the tournament. There's quite a bit of putting off the green there, isn't there?
A lot, yes. I actually spoke to Tim Clark, one of the South African guys.
One of the great chippers.
Great guy. Didn't like chipping at all.
Oh, really? Is he terrible, is he?
He hated chipping. And I said, mate, how do you get around Augusta? It's the hardest place to chip in the world. He goes, it's the best place in the world because you don't have to chip.
Oh, yeah.
So he was great with the little floppy ones and all that, but that little grainy stuff, and he reckons he just putted it. It's a nasty place to chip. It asks a lot of questions on your chipping and your pace and your contact. If you're just a smidgen out, it made you look very silly.
It is interesting looking at Augusta over the years, how well Europeans play around there and non-Americans. Like, it's something about that place, whether it's the green complexes, or it's the artistic value of playing the game, or as you said, getting it on the correct shelves. It's like hitting greens in regulation isn't the big deal around there.
It's not quite good enough. Like, to shoot a score, you've got to hit it in the right spots. And if you actually watch the really good players, they actually, I remember 97 when I just walked around and watched it. I followed Nicklaus and a couple of the other like greats. And there were certain flags, they just hit it into certain spots. And you thought, well, why didn't they have? And then once you start playing there, then you go, oh, okay. Because the penalty, if you get it wrong, far outweighs what you're getting out of it. At the end of the day, the one thing you can't beat is length.
Yeah, it seems like that. And Peter, when you're talking about you weren't quite long enough, Jesus, you weren't actually short. I mean, is it an elite level of length that you have to beat to perform there? Because there has been historically some shorter hitters that have won by laying up on those par fives, isn't there?
Yes, which obviously shows that I'm not very good with my wedges.
Yeah, sorry to expose.
Very good with my wedges. But, you know, I could never work it out. I think the last time I played, you know, I think I shot like 3 under the first round and should have been 6 or 7 under. And I thought, oh, I think I've got this. And then the next day I shot like 100. So I never quite had it. But I think the greens have a lot of slope in them. They get faster every day. And if you're going to hold putts, your pace and line has to be perfect. Like, there's a lot of courses you can get away with, you know, right left, just hit it hard. Whereas Augusta, you just had to be the perfect line. It had to be matched with the perfect speed, which I think probably I wasn't.
And we're talking greens that you can actually putt off. Putt into a hazard. I mean, the world's greatest golfer putted clean off a green there.
Yeah, I was actually the group behind him when he putted into that water.
Oh, fair dinkum.
10, 11, 12, on 13, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So there was a big kerfuffle in front of us, and someone said, oh, Tiger's just putted it into the water.
What was the crowd reaction? I mean, the moaning, the groans would have been deafening, wouldn't they?
Just total shock. I actually had one where I played with Fred Funk. I'm not sure which year it was, the first couple of rounds. And the first day I got off to a bit of a bad start, which I always seem to do. But anyway, I got to the first hole the second day and I said, okay, I've just got to settle down, just get through a couple, just make 4 or 5 pars in a row and get going. And so the pin was in the front left, and Fred hit it straight at the hole, hit it just on the back edge. And then he putted it into the bunker at the front of the green. And then he chipped it out and it ran off his ear to about 50 feet. And then he held it for bogey and went to the net. So I was like, I didn't know what to look at. When I saw it going, I was like, oh, no, I don't want to see that.
Bad luck, Fred.
I had a similar line. I'm like, so, you know, my first part is thinking, just don't hit in the bunker. Just don't hit in the bunker.
That's a different style of golf course. Pete, thank you, mate, for being part of the show. And your insights are fascinating. I'm sure you've got a million other stories, and we'd love to get you back on again very soon. Thanks, Peter. Thanks very much for being on Backspin.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you, mate.
I'd like to mention our friends at BMW. They've been long-standing supporters of golf, not only in Australia, but around the world for over 35 years. And they continue to be a huge part of the landscape of our game. It's not just international PGA Tour golf. 45 years ago, BMW created the world's largest amateur golf tournament with around 100,000 golfers from 50 countries competing worldwide. The BMW Cup is the most renowned and largest international tournament series for non-professional golfers. If any listeners are interested in being part of this amazing event, contact your nearest BMW dealer. From a long-standing PGA member, thank you, BMW.
Backspin with Larry Canning and Gary Barter.
Oh, yeah.
Craig Parry, welcome to Backspin, mate.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Absolute pleasure. It's Masters Week. It's the beginning. It's the Monday of the Masters, Gaz. It's exciting. We're all excited. Craig, speaking of that, we'd love to ask you, firstly, about your first trip down Magnolia Lane. What was it like? Was it great? Was it exciting? Was it nerve-wracking?
You know what? My first year was 1990, and I actually didn't go down Magnolia Lane.
Oh. Staff entrance.
Yeah, I went in through the player entrance, which is like a gate number 3 or something like that. It might have been gate number 5. And I didn't actually go down the main drag the first year that I went there.
Was that intentional?
No. I just, one of those things, I just didn't go down the main driveway. And then the next time I come back in 92, I did it every day.
I reckon I would have too. And your first experiences of being part of the Masters, you know, the people walking around, the members, the green jackets.
It's an amazing place. And it's very unique. You can really only do what the Masters do because of, one, the golf course, the history. If they invite the golfers to actually go and play there, even though you might be past Masters champion, they don't necessarily have to invite you. If they don't want to invite you, they don't invite you. It's a private golf club. And, you know, all the invitations are actually handwritten. And the player gets a letter from Augusta asking them to participate in the tournament. Then you write back a letter saying, yeah, I'd love to go and play. Thank you. Thanks for the invite.
What I didn't realise when Matt played, it's a huge big folder as well.
Yeah. Like
you've got that letter, as you said, but there's a massive folder of multiple. There's so much information.
Like restrictions, what you got to wear, what you got to, what deodorant you got to have.
No, it's just a really good presentation.
Arrogate? Like no, Arrogate.
They don't need it there, mate.
Yeah.
It's a very unique event, and the players have the history in our game that they all adhere to what the rules are, and you know, no one breaks it because they want to get back in the following year.
Were there things you couldn't say?
Oh, sure. There's plenty of things you can't say about a lot of places.
Yeah, no, yeah.
You'd never get back.
Were they listed?
No. No, there was unwritten things you can't do or say or what have you, but you didn't need to have them written anyway because, you know, it's just being polite.
I mean, with interviews and stuff, you might refer to the fans instead of...
That's a little bit different, the fans. You know, they were...
Patrons.
In the early 90s, it was a totally different crowd to what would be going there today. And no one ever knows how many spectators or patrons, as they call them, actually visit the golf course. But, you know, every time you look out from the putting green, everyone's going around with 5 or 6 different bags full of goodies from the merchandise tent, and that happens every single day. So unless the new people go on there, they're walking away with a lot of merchandise.
Even coaching, as a coach.
Gary, you've been there as a coach.
I'm not allowed on the greens at all during the practice rounds. No. You're restricted. You can't go on the greens. We could walk on the fairway, the practice rounds. But I found that odd. I found that really weird that, you know, you're a coach. As Paz said, there's very strict rules.
So when you got that invitation, Paz, were you expecting it or hoping?
More or less hoping. First time I got to play there wasn't out of the blue back in 1990. I'd won the Italian and Scottish Open the previous year in 89 in Europe. And I finished, I think, 3rd on the Order of Merit. So there was a pretty good chance I was going to get a run. But you can't take anything for granted, especially with Augusta, because they are a private golf club that can do whatever they like.
It is an extraordinary event for that reason. I find even now, and it's changing, it's softening, the view is being softened by Fred Ridley, I believe, to the tournament's benefit in the world of golf, really, because there's players from all over the world now getting invitations, tournaments that you can qualify to get in the Masters, the Australian Open. Neergaard Pedersen got in. But back in 1990, I'd imagine it would have been very Americanized, Craig. If you weren't playing in America, it must have been tough to get in.
If you weren't playing in America, it was nearly impossible because, you know, there was no events other than the Open Championship that was exempt for Augusta. So you'd have to be a pretty good player to get exempt in the Masters through winning the Open. Otherwise, you had to win on the US Tour, and really that was about the only way back in the early 90s. I think they had about 5 invitations they gave to players from all over the world. So same thing, you had to be pretty exceptional to get a run.
So your first tee shot, first hole, tough tee shot back then. I mean, even back then with the old equipment.
It was difficult. You know, it's a par 4 bunker up on the right-hand side, big hollow in front of the tee. I had to always get driver off the first tee, whereas as the golf balls got longer, players started to use 3-wood off the tee and then go into the green with anywhere from a 7-iron to, you know, a pitching wedge, depending on where the wind was blowing. And obviously, you know, you had to hit it in the correct position off the tee to have the best angle going into the green. And, you know, it's like a game of chess playing the Augusta. So you have to hit it in the correct position off the tee to start with. And then if it was a par four, play the next shot under the hole so you have an opportunity for birdie.
So, Paz, fast forward to 92.
Yep.
You'd be very happy with me. I watched it this morning. I watched just about every shot. So you led by three after two holes into the last round.
Yeah.
And I had a look at it, and you hit the ball really well the last round. Like, it was surprising because all those years have gone by. Like, obviously, we watched it back then, but many, many years goes by. And when I looked at it today, I thought, you hit the ball really well. Like, hit a lot of close shots, but you missed eight putts inside 6 feet, which I'm sure you'd be happy that I remind you of that.
Yeah, look, I did analyse my round, and I did hit it under the hole, more or less the whole day on that Sunday. What actually happened on Sunday, we had to come back and finish our third round. I played with Wisdom in the second and last group, I think it was. It might have been the last group on that Saturday, and I hadn't cut the greens out in the golf course. So the greens out in the golf course on the Sunday afternoon, the greens were a lot slower. So, you know, you go to the putting green, and the green is extremely quick, and then you go out in the golf course, and it's a totally different speed. And I was getting ready for the practice green, which was, you know, running at, say, 14 on the centimeter, and you got out on the golf course and they're running about 12. And I couldn't make the adjustment to actually hit the ball hard enough on the putting green to get it to the hole. And that was my downfall.
You were still right in there. Like, when couples got that lucky break on 12, like, it was amazing.
Just to put the listeners into the picture, guys, what happened on 12 with Fred Couples? Those who have forgotten.
Yeah, so Fred hits his tee shot and he hits that classic little bit weak, little bit to the right, and it hits the bank right of the pin. And it's every year it goes in the water. It's like Jordan did it. Many players have done it. It hangs up unbelievably. Yeah. It hangs up. And
the reason it hung up, we had the rain on the Friday afternoon and on the Saturday, heavy rain. So the Rays Creek had actually risen. So the banks on the creek were actually soggy and very, very soft. So that's how his ball was actually able to remain up on the bank, because when it went in, it actually plugged into the bank and then went back up onto where the top of the plug mark was. So it was actually sitting up on the tee. Normally that would go into the water and be firm on the bank, but it was actually soft.
Wow.
So he gets it up and down, makes three.
Well, no, what I found amazing, Paz then he tees up after that.
Yeah.
And you'd made a really good putt on 11. Like, I thought that was a great, like, second putt. And you sort of like, you almost like, you could see the, like, to the crowd, you made this gesture like, God, I finally made a putt or a two-putt. And then you were still in the tournament then, I think only three back. And Fred nearly hits in the water. Then you hit an unbelievable shot. It was probably 4.5, 5 feet maybe, or 3 feet. Incredible shot on the last day. Then you miss it, you know, and it's sort of like, and then on 13, you hit an unbelievable tee shot. Second shot could have caught the back edge of the green, and it just trickled over the back. And then you chip it down reasonably close again. And it's like you couldn't get momentum, could you? It was unbelievable how hard you would have ground that last round out.
It was a tough day, and I probably needed a bit more experience looking back in it over the years, because you have to sort of get close a couple of times before you can actually work out how to do it. Very few players are actually able to work out how to win, especially under extreme pressure of a major. And obviously at that point, there was no Aussie had won Augusta at that point. So, you know, I think you and I had a play together. I reckon one of us would have won.
Yeah.
Because he played with Raymond and Floyd and I played with Couples. And, you know, it just would have been a different probably feeling, you know, as far as, you know, Finchie and I have been very comfortable playing with each other. We practiced together, played nearly all our practice rounds together as well. So,
Craig, thanks for being part of Backspin. It was fantastic talking to you, and we hope to be talking to you soon.
Paz, thanks again, mate. Really appreciate those insights.
No worries at all, mate.
So good speaking to you. You know, had an unbelievable career, and Masters Week's a special week for all of us, but definitely special for you. Cheers, mate.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for Craig Parry and Peter Lonard, guys, for talking to us about their Masters experiences. Very insightful. Love listening to it. We'll be back after the Masters to discuss who won the bet between you and I.
Cheers, mate.
Good on you, mate. See you, listeners. See you next time.